Welcome to the Pratfalls Podcast, a show that features conversations with creative people about their work and their lives. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen, but who cares about that? Before I get into the episode, I want to do a big plug up front. So my friend Maddie Gibba, who is a comedian and a performer and an improviser and a brilliant writer and a creator, she has an Indiegogo campaign right now for a project called Down and Out. She wants to make a pilot for a musical comedy for the TV, and I think you should support it. If you go to Indiegogo.com and look up Maddie Gibba or Down and Out, I'll put a link in as well. You should go check out what she wants to put together and support the crap out of it. Maddie is wonderful, and she does wonderful work, and I would love to see a thing she wants to make actually exist in the world. So please check that out. This episode is my conversation with Katie Cisneros. Katie is a bunch of things. She is, I think, first and foremost, a writer, and a writer in a lot of different ways. She writes on the internet. She writes on paper. She is about to get her PhD in literature. She's doing so many things connected to words, and we talked all about that and so much more. So I think you guys will enjoy this conversation, which means I'm going to stop telling you about it and instead just let it start happening. Here's my conversation with Katie. All right, well, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions, personal and professional.
Great. And you can have answers. Hopefully. Well,
that's a big promise. Well, so you're Katie Cisneros.
I am.
And did I say that's right?
Cisneros, yeah.
Cisneros.
I always get the impression that all the white people in my family say it wrong because it's a Mexican name. And so I imagine that it's this, all the white faction of my family is just saying it with the wrong accent, but yeah. We just have to accept that that's how it goes.
Yeah. Well, I'm Weinhagen, which that's how you say it in,
is that German?
In the Midwest. Yeah, but it'd be Weinhagen.
Weinhagen, which sounds so much cooler. Why don't you go by that?
No, all the A's get all ugly and Fargo-ish.
That's true. That's true.
Nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
So I want to try and say what I think of your work.
Oh boy.
What it is, not what I think of it quality.
Like, what's your... I think it's kind of weird.
We'll get into
boring.
That.
Okay.
Underwhelming, yet oppressive. Is that? No.
I could actually probably make an argument for why both of those are true, but I won't.
You're a writer, I think. So then I'll list all these, and then you can tell me how wrong I am or what buckets I missed.
Sure.
A writer, a digital media strategist.
Yeah.
And a scholar.
Uh-huh.
And then also a host of sorts.
Yes.
Like a live event type host.
Mm-hmm. Are those I think you hit the big four.
Good.
That's no the four. You hit the four.
The four.
There aren't
There's not some
ones.
Secret.
Well, does dog mom count?
No.
I kind of hate that term, so
pretty
it doesn't
bad,
count.
Actually.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your relationship to dog mom as a term. Are you one of those dog mommy bloggers?
No.
Is that a thing?
No. Yes. I wouldn't doubt that for a second. I don't like dog mom. Mostly because it seems to undervalue the concept of mom.
Yes.
Like, I'm not a mom. Right. I'm just a dog owner.
Right. But you're pretty into your dog.
Well, when you live alone, you live alone in a house with a dog, what else are you going to be into? The dishes? Like,
it's true.
Although I am pretty into doing the dishes, too.
Really?
Yeah. I like to keep tidy. I don't know. Do the dishes, hang out with the dog. Have a whiskey, go to bed.
This is great because we're getting like straight to neuroses.
Yeah, like, we really are.
There's no.
I did
like,
not pump the brakes on this one
bit. Which I'm really excited about. Does not at all like upset the apple cart of my expectations of
Thank goodness.
Katie.
Like, this is precisely what you expected to come out of my brain.
Well, because so I want you to speak on those sort of work platforms, but I know you in weird contexts.
Yeah.
And so I'm just going to like.
Yeah.
Here will be my take on you. So, like, I don't know if we first met on the internet, that feels like, at least,
yeah,
like, awareness,
I think that's
internet-wise.
Probably likely.
And then in real life, things happened. But then I think you're, like, weird and funny.
Uh-huh.
And, like, in control of your weird funniness.
As
but then
much
also,
as I can
like,
be,
you forget
yeah.
that it's happening sometimes.
Yeah.
So, like, I enjoy that a lot, and I see it bleed into all your spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you'll be talking about, you know, you're pursuing a pretty high-level degree.
As far as I know, unless there's something higher than PhD.
Well, I'm
sure
it's
the highest. At least at that level. There are gradations of getting a PhD.
Is an honorary doctorate better, like, somehow?
Better in that it's easier, yes. Yeah. But it's not like I'm getting a PhD in, like, neuroscience.
What is your PhD in?
English literature.
Yeah.
17th century British. literature.
I have so many questions, but I'm just going to say why.
That's a good question. I think because, I mean, I was never, no, I'm not going to make it about what I wasn't good at, because that's not why I do it.
Please,
I don't do it.
You're not good at.
I don't do it because there were other things I wasn't good at, and this was the only thing I was good at, because I was always a voracious reader. Mm-hmm. I really liked writing, and that doesn't, ostensibly, that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with academia, but I found myself in high school very drawn to the act of active reading, of intricate and responsive reading, and the sort of like making marginalia notes when the first time I read, you know, Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet. And I was drawn to the older stuff, I think because I've always been an Anglophile. Since sixth grade, I've been very interested in like the Middle Ages and England and knights and damsels, although damsels, the ahistorical problems that I that I have to go back and like reevaluate from the years that I was very obsessed with the Middle Ages. I'll get there.
Yeah,
probably
feminism
in therapy.
Can really muck up your early reading.
It's a problem.
Yeah.
And so I kind of found a way to meld the two. And once I got, at first I started in college as a creative writing emphasis, or that was my undergraduate's creative writing. But I knew I wanted to go into academia, and Shakespeare felt right for me because Shakespeare's kind of like math for English nerds. You can really, really spend a lot of time with not a lot of text and find so much. It's just a treasure trove of stuff, be it lyrical or historical or character-wise, you name it. There are ways to spend so much time with texts, these old English texts that feel a little foreign to us, but aren't because they're the same language, they're just, it's like Twilight Zone style of English language. And I just found that very riveting. And I don't actually do Shakespeare now, but I am more or less in the same time period. I kind of stumbled into my...
I can tell you're working on your dissertation, because this is all like tip of your tongue. Like you are like... I hardly had to say anything.
I mean, I have to think about it a lot.
Yeah.
I do, because, well, in part, it's at the forethought of my brain because I'm doing it, but also I feel like we as academics, but especially English professionals, have to constantly justify what we've decided to do with our lives to anyone. Like why?
Right.
It's like talking to my grandpa anytime somebody asks, wait, you're still in college? And I have to be like, deep breath, Katie. No, I'm not in college. It's not quite that simple. I'm a professional. I'm a graduate student. I am getting a high level degree. This is my job. I have taught classes in this. Like, I know what I'm doing.
Right.
But yes, I go to a college campus and I hang out with undergrads, and okay, fine, I'm in college. Like, it's kind of an existential crisis.
Well, and you look young, too.
Like, I sure hope I do, because I just turned 30.
Not to make it an aesthetic assessment of you, but like...
As long as I'm still getting carded at bars, I won't totally break down.
was there a time when you had to transition to thinking, I'm going to be a creative writer, to I'm going to be an academic, and that's where the writing creativity mostly goes? Like, when...
You know, Yeah, mentally I feel like I made that switch when I was applying for grad school. And I knew that I wasn't going to pursue the higher education.
Because you've written a bunch of, like, creative work.
Yeah, but well after that point.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I did a lot of writing for myself as an undergrad, and especially in high school, that's never seen the light of day.
Is it in the drawer?
Yeah, I've got like a 140-page novella that I wrote in high school after I got my first computer.
Is it going to be like Kafka style, published after you die? And
I would love that. It's
you've got to tell someone to destroy it. That's the key to getting it published.
Then you know it won't get destroyed.
Yeah.
You're right. A la Willa Cather's letters and Kafka's manuscripts.
Just magical.
You're right. Thank goodness Willa Cather, whoever was in charge of her letters, though, I don't remember who it was, but she didn't destroy them. And now my alma mater is the one we archive those, because she's a Nebraskan.
Oh, wow.
And so University
of
Nebraska,
people
Lincoln.
Yeah, betray their dear friend's trust. Like,
thank
it,
goodness.
It has really
Let's
helped.
Let's applaud those people.
Culture and art.
Yeah. It has, actually, a number of times. How was I talking about? I went on a Willa Cather rant. Haven't we all?
That comes up a lot.
I know.
Another one of those.
Yep.
No, the transition from am I a creative writer or am I academic? Not that those are opposed. Like, there are plenty of professors.
They're not. They're actually not. They're surprisingly not opposed, because oftentimes the thing that my advisor and I will end up sitting down and talking about is, well, is there a paragraph that sounds clunky, or do we need to work on the verbiage a little bit?
It's the same sorts of communicating clearly.
It absolutely is, especially now that I'm writing the introduction, which is the last thing you write when you're writing a dissertation.
Here's what it is and why you should read it.
Precisely. And that requires so much less just footnoting and quoting of sources,
right.
And it's less like let me prove to you I know the intricacies of this
right.
field or this topic, and more, please, for the love of God, let me tell you why you should read this
document. It's your dating profile.
It really is, which is terrifying.
And the other stuff is
just as terrifying to write. Yeah. It's please date my dissertation for like 3 hours and read it. So they're not as unrelated to each other as you might think. But so in my brain, I went, you know, no, that's okay. Maybe I'll, you know, creative write on the side, but I'm going to do this academia thing and I'm going to go full bore with it. And I did for a while. And I was...
You're teaching, right?
Not anymore, right?
But
not
you were.
Right. I was. Yeah. I was, because that's how you get paid. If you're in a graduate program, if you're in a master's program and you're teaching, you're lucky, because that means you're getting paid. Not a lot of universities offer paid master's programs, and they should, I think. PhD, it's a lot more common. You're probably going to be teaching and getting a miserly stipend to do it, and then tuition covered and all that. But I was dedicated to it for a long time, but then I moved here, and I
felt... Where did you move from?
Nebraska. So I lived in Lincoln for 6 years. Oh, okay. Got my master's and bachelor's there. I'm from western Nebraska.
Nice.
A little tiny town.
Yeah.
Which... Yeah, maybe we'll get into that later. and I just started, I found myself...
If I was born in Nebraska, I think... I mean, I already was a big reader, but I could see that making someone into...
Not a ton else
a world
to
of
do.
Fantasy.
Yeah. Let's pay attention to other things, other than my real life surroundings. And that actually really might be the breakdown as to why I read as much as I did. Mm. But my mom also read to me a lot when I was little, before I could read. And I think that, above all else, I think that made the biggest difference.
Was your mom an educator?
Nope. No, but she could be really, really good at that if she wanted to. She just graduated from college, actually. She got her bachelor's at the beginning of May. She's job hunting right now. If anybody in Omaha, Nebraska wants to hire my mom, she'd be really super into that, and I would be too, because that woman is better at any job you give her than anyone else who has ever attempted that job. Huh. It does not matter what it is.
I'm a fan of your mom.
She's great.
Just from the little contact I've had.
She backed your Kickstarter.
She did. Yeah.
My mom's cool.
And sent me a nice message, too.
And she would be a really good educator because she's pushed my sisters and I so hard, I think.
Yeah, I have an obsession with sort of parent-adult-child relationships, so everything else you said, I don't care anymore.
We're moving on.
No, I still want to talk about that stuff.
Sure.
But, like, I am really curious about... So your mom just finished college now, but you have been... I mean, you've heavily invested in education.
I've never not been in school.
Like, that is a commitment. I've never really gotten from you the impression that you were doing it to avoid grown-up life.
No.
That is often the thing. I've known plenty of folks in graduate school who were like, clearly we just didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And they were like, I guess I just keep moving down this track because I'm terrified of the world. And you seem
I never
like
had my
you,
sights on anything else.
You have other things that could totally be your whole thing, and you're like, yeah, I'm still doing this very intense thing.
For now.
Right.
I think that's
But I wonder
sort of
how
big...
was that modeled for you? Where did you get the idea that you could be... Who do you think you are that you could be an academic? Like, did your mom say education matters?
It's not about... Oh, yeah, always. But I was also pretty good at motivating myself. I think if we're gonna cut deep, let's cut deep.
What are you afraid of?
Oh, what am I not afraid of would be a much shorter answer.
Okay, listen to that.
So, no, I mean, when I was a kid, I was hyperactive. I was high strung. I had pretty severe anxieties. I had a hectic home life I was finding difficult to translate into reality because I didn't see any of my friends having the same thing necessarily. So I felt at odds with that. And I was smart, but not particularly popular or likable because of my hyperactivity and my anxieties. And I think that just meant I found the thing that I could do best and I just freaking clung to it like a life preserver. And that was being the smart one in class.
And did it make you like have confidence? Like it was the one spot where you felt competent too?
I think there's a difference between feeling competence and confidence in something because,
a point an academic would make.
Yeah. I'm going to really nitpick at this. I felt competent, yes, but the problem was that sometimes... It's not even that I was objectively the smartest kid in my class. I likely very much was not. Mm-hmm. But I was the one who appeared the most dedicated to the academic pursuits. Mm-hmm. I was the one who tried the hardest in class. That meant I often was getting high grades. And that doesn't... When you're already not popular, that doesn't exactly win you a lot of brownie points
with
your friends.
Caring about school can be death for social...
Yeah, exactly. So competent, yes. Confident, no. And sometimes it actually just made things worse. but I preferred the competence. I preferred to have that because I wasn't going to be winning homecoming queen, that's for damn sure. So
maybe if you just put the kind of wasteful energy into your academics, into your social game.
See, I would have had to have started when I was like 4, and I wasn't going to succeed then. So, yeah, no. I think that's, and so it wasn't a matter of my mom being like, yeah, you can go into academia, and this is something you can do. It was more like my mom was very hell-bent on making sure we knew we could do literally whatever we wanted, anything. And that happened to be the thing that I wanted to pursue. And I think you can see it in my sisters as well.
Are they all doing?
They're all doing the thing that we all thought they'd be doing from the age of 5. All 3 of us. You could just sort of like, if you look back through our childhoods, you're like, oh yeah, this makes sense. You know, my little sister, littlest sister, is about to, she'll graduate in May from my alma mater, University of Nebraska-Lincoln, with a degree in like fashion merchandising and something or other. She's going to kill me for not knowing exactly what her major was called, but she's damn good at it. She's extremely dedicated, and I can tell that she has these like precise goals in mind. Mm. My middle sister, she's getting her RN, she's going to be a nurse in December. And she wants to go on and get a doctor level nursing degree.
Oh, wow.
And she wants to do like mental health nursing. That we just like you, and she's always been into like biology and anatomy and all these things in school. So all 3 of us, it was just a matter of like we were never given even the slightest inclination in our lives that something we wanted to do wasn't something we could ultimately pursue. So we just did.
Did you see your mom doing what she wanted? Like
no. No, and I think that actually is maybe a large part of why we did what we did. I think that, I mean, my mom had me when she was 25. She had a full ride to college, didn't stay in college. We haven't fully talked about why, she has a lot of regrets is my point.
Yeah.
And that's why she went back to school and got her bachelor's. And she's very proud of that. We are also extremely proud of it because we feel like, I'm speaking for me and my sisters here, which I hope
like
they're okay
the
with.
That we is just your just psychosis
we.
Happening.
it's all the voices in my brain. We here in my head are quite proud of my mom. Because we do feel like it's like the first time in the time that we've known her as a human being that she's had the capacity, not in herself, but just in her life, and had the freedom to do something wholly for herself.
Yeah.
Because she's always been raising 1, 2, or 3 girls. So no, we didn't. I don't think she would disagree either. Like, I don't think she has regrets about us or about. I mean, I know she feels like she can live vicariously through us and our various successes, but it was high time mom got to do mom.
Yeah. So she was putting in that kind of energy into making sure you guys were finding your way.
Yeah, which it took us some time to realize. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the selfishness of being a teenager and an adolescent is you need to grow out of. You need to grow into the realization that even though you're not the center of the world, there are some people who make you the center of their world. And it's hard to find the strength to even, like, appreciate that sometimes.
Well, because it's made to be taken for granted. Like, it's not, you're not supposed to notice it.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's we really didn't. That's why she's good at what she does.
And then it's weird when you do.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, what else have I been missing?
I know. What else have I been underappreciating? Like, how is the world working around me in ways I don't even understand? And so that's, yeah, we really get good on going off on threads here. Yeah. I don't remember what I was talking about. But I don't want to stay in academia. I'm not going to go on the job market and be an English professor for various reasons.
Well, it's rough.
It's rough.
I have a bias. I have an academia bias, I'll acknowledge. But a lot of it for me comes through, so I have a degree in anthropology, but I did a heavy emphasis on creative writing, and I considered graduate school in that area, and then I had sort of a realization of, like, I think that's a way of tricking writers into teaching more people who want to be writers to be teachers, to teach more people who want to be writers. Like, I just, like, couldn't stop looking at the vicious cycle that happens in certain sectors of academia.
It's possible to be optimistic about that line of thought. It's possible you can tell yourself, well, but someone's got to teach them, and it's not like you can't be doing what you're doing while you're teaching them. But I think grad school can kind of beat that optimism out of you, because I really found it, I found it next to impossible to do any of my own work while I was teaching even a 1-1 teaching load, one class per semester.
Because you're committed to the work, right?
Because you're teaching, and if you're going to be good at it, you're going to be dedicated to it. And you have a classroom of 25-plus students that you see 3 days a week, and you're grading papers, and you're writing lectures, and it's even just... But it also, we can't do it on autopilot yet because we haven't taught enough yet. Once I had taught 8 semesters of just composition rhetoric, it's a little autopilot-y, but like the last thing I taught was a year of Shakespeare, and it was just, it was work every day.
Actual questions you can't just answer that you haven't encountered.
But. Especially because I am no expert on Shakespeare. Yes, I know more about him than anyone else in this room right now. Not this room, the classroom, but
probably
this room
still,
too, probably. Yeah. and so it's a constant struggle to like walk into the room and say, okay, I have to be the expert here. And that doesn't mean pretending you know all the answers. It's about sounding authoritative when you do and explaining why you don't have some of the answers or why we as a, like in the scholarship field don't have all of the answers. And I found that really rewarding because none of them really challenged me on that. That's the fear when you're like a young female academic is you're constantly getting challenged on things. And luckily, I've felt it before in many avenues from students to professors, but in my Shakespeare classrooms, they really just were into it.
Do you think they assumed you were a man playing a woman?
That would have been apropos, considering that we read like The Twelfth Night and other cross-dressing plays, and certainly would have been a funny angle into a theme, but hopefully not. Hopefully that is not what they were thinking.
We can't challenge her because
she might be a dude.
Super traditional to Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. hope not.
Well, so I mentioned you have these other things. Like, you're a writer in a bunch of ways.
Yeah.
Like, you're a part of, or you, I don't know what your status is now, but
the tangential.
Yeah, tangential.
We're around. We just celebrated our 5th anniversary.
Which is like an online magazine thing.
Yeah. There's content.
I think mostly, all of mine are like perceptions of you. Mostly you seem to write getting drunk-based essays. Maybe not mostly.
Whether
I'm writing
about getting drunk or not, the likelihood of me being drunk is high.
They're not about getting drunk, but usually you upfront admit there was whiskey involved, and that drove this line of reasoning.
You gotta get rid of the inhibitions at least a little bit if you're going to write, especially if you're going to write like... For the internet, because that's just a cesspool of hate. The internet is
broad strokes.
So,
speaking as a white man, I've never had any problems on the internet.
Well, of course not.
Real life.
Yeah, everything's just been going swimmingly for you, hasn't it?
Yes, and stupidly, I'm trying to change that. I don't know what's wrong with me.
You're a good man, Levi, that's why. Don't embrace
your privilege. That's all I
want to hear. It just makes you an asshole.
I know.
Yeah, don't do that. I don't embrace my privilege either. I'm aware of it.
A little bit you do.
But,
come on. It's not
bad being a middle-class white girl in America.
No.
But I can travel well.
Worse than being a middle-class white dude.
Slightly worse, yes.
Yes.
I'm also left-handed. I'm a huge minority. So, well, I'm a very small minority, I suppose, I mean to say.
A huge minority. But I want to know, like, the writing for the internet thing. You write in a lot of different ways for the internet. Mm-hmm. Because in your, like, your digital media stuff,
that's another
version of writing for the internet.
Yeah.
But in a very specific way. I don't know how much you like talking about that work that you do.
My work thing?
Yeah.
I like talking about it, but it's tough.
Because it's fascinating, and you get weird praise.
I also get a lot of hate.
I'm sure you do.
Oh my goodness gracious. You just have to learn to deal with the trolls. So, yeah. So I do the social media for Totino's. So if you follow @Totino's, like as in like party pizzas and pizza rolls.
Right.
If you follow them on Twitter or Facebook or Tumblr, that's me.
The pizza roll avatar is
familiar. Yep. And I'm the voice of that brand.
Pizza roll.
Pizza roll. Very good. Yeah. And I have a couple designers that help me with the content and stuff. But the copy is me. And the brand, the social presence of the brand has grown so much just in the time that I've been on it, largely because my bosses are so good at their jobs,
But that, also, you have a fair amount of free reign, right?
I have nothing but free reign.
Yeah.
No, I'm one of the brand. Legal doesn't have to necessarily, although they may balk at hearing this, but they don't approve my tweets. Right. I just have to use my good judgment, which has more or less served me well. I'm pretty careful with what I say within a lot less strict constraints than other people have at the same.
You play with tone, but you watch language.
Exactly. Really, I'm ultimately still under the umbrella of General Mills, which still owns Cheerios, so we're all in that sort of family brand thing.
You don't want to muck up the Lucky Charms brand.
Right. God forbid. And I know the people who do Lucky Charms and Cheerios and all these other, I know these people. I don't want to ruin things for them. But, so I'm very careful, but I do get to play with language a lot, and it's honestly the best creative writing gig I've ever had.
Yeah, so talk about that. Why is that the case? What about it?
Well, the obvious reason, first of all, is that the second I write anything, at least 160,000 people see it.
Yeah. You're testing ideas in real time.
Which is both good and bad. It's good when it goes over well. It's kind of crushing when it doesn't. Mm. But at least I get immediate feedback. Kind of right away.
What's worse, though? Somebody being a bunch of angry people or no reaction at all?
I think it depends on who you are. It depends on what you can deal with best.
Yeah.
And I prefer angry people to no readership at all.
Because you get a reaction, right?
I like sometimes being the center of attention if I'm in control of what I'm giving to the world.
Yeah.
And so I think I can maybe deal better with reactions. There are some people who probably just couldn't. And it can be really... The hate is tough, right? It's the internet, and it's all these people who you can't see, and they know that, and they're willing to just say whatever the hell they want to you, and it's the brand. It's not me. It's the brand, but it's still directed at like this thing that you did, and you put at least a modicum of work into, and you really need to learn to like compartmentalize that. I've even had issues with people who, like, would troll the Totino's account, and then they figured out that it was me who wrote for the account, and they followed my personal account and were like tweeting at me, and I just immediately had to put the kibosh on that and say, nope, block, 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 block. We're not going to mix worlds here. And that can be a little bit scary. So it's the best job in that building, I think, because I get total creative freedom. My team trusts me to make the right decisions for them and not get everybody fired, me first of all.
What's good incentive for you to do it well, too, is...
Very much. I mean, I constantly have to be on my toes.
Yeah.
And I hope I maintain that.
Before you were doing that job, did you think of yourself as a joke writer?
No.
Because there's a lot of things you do there, but there's some hard, actual joke writing that's happening on a regular basis.
No, yeah. No, I didn't.
Which people try to do and fail at who are social media managers of accounts all the time.
I know.
Like, it is...
And I look at some accounts that I admire, and
horrible.
I'm like, man, I wish I wrote like that. Like, I still have that, like, I'm just not nearly as good as these other accounts. And I don't do it on my personal Twitter nearly as much as I have to do it on my, like, I'm usually just observational, like, life stuff on my Twitter, because that's my personal one. And it's not the same as, like, the humor writing. I think that most if not all of what I do for the tangential is humor writing.
Yeah.
And there's some joke stuff in there, but it's long-form essay. I can build out jokes.
Right.
I can call back to things. No, I kind of had to learn. I had to discover whether or not I had an aptitude for it when I started the job, and I'm still not entirely convinced I do. Like, I am not. I could be so much better than I am at that account, and that's something I think about every day. Which is a little.
Right.
It sounds like it should be kind of a drag to constantly have that thought, but
no,
it does keep me working hard.
That means you're an actual joke writer.
I suppose.
I don't know anyone who's a good joke writer who thinks they're good at writing jokes.
Yeah.
As soon as you think you're good at it, then you're terrible.
The second you hit enter, the second you hit send, you're like, oh, that's terrible. Let's let the hate flow. And sometimes they do better than others, and I'm proud of that. Like, I feel good. And there are some jokes that I've written that didn't necessarily get the attention I was hoping for, but I look at it and I go, you're all wrong. This is fucking hilarious. I hope I can curse. I'm sorry.
I don't know why it took you so long.
That's a good point. I did call you an asshole earlier, though. So.
That's true. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm emotionally connected to a lot of the content that I make, but it is a constant exercise in that old Shakespearean line, brevity is the soul of wit.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing proves that more than the crap jokes you can find on Twitter.
Yeah, but the weird thing is, even on Twitter, people will use too many words.
Yeah.
And that is
even
such
with the limitations they have.
Thing.
Yep.
that it's really hard, because I think it's really hard to learn. Like, mm-hmm. usually fewer words are better.
I've even thought, even with the 140 characters that I have, I've often felt like the Totino's account, I take too much advantage of all those characters, mm-hmm. that I could be doing better with keeping things shorter.
Well, there's a really fun thing if you can hit 140 exactly and still feel like it's
That's
a good
true.
Bit of business.
I get really angry if I get to the end of a tweet and I'm at 140, but I haven't put the final punctuation mm-hmm. mark yet. And I'm
you
like,
make that
no, now I have to delete
Sophie's
an entire
choice.
Word. Like, I'm not leaving it as punctuationless. I'm not a savage. But yeah, no, it's weird. It's weird to walk in there every day and know that I have that certain people don't, not just, they have perceptions of what my job is, mm-hmm. which is only sort of tied to reality.
Just eating pizza rolls all day long.
Eating pizza rolls, writing jokes, and that's kind of true.
Right.
But not, it's not true enough that it's quite as easy as that sounds. And then that means they have some expectations of me that I often worry I can't deliver on.
What are, like, that you're super fun and chill? Like, what are
I am super fun and chill.
Oh, yeah.
Levi.
I feel so chill right
now.
Are you
so relaxed?
Just being around you?
No, as I said, all those anxieties and high-strungedness that I had as a kid never went away. I just learned how to harness it.
That's adulthood.
It's like when what's his butt? Who's the... With the...
I wish everyone could see your weird goggly gesture you're making.
No, the superhero guy.
Yeah, that's how
Cyclops. Works.
Oh, okay.
Cyclops has this uncontrollable laser vision, but
yeah.
when he puts the glasses on, then he can harness it.
You know you called Cyclops superhero butt just now? You should know that.
I thought I said guy. I probably said butt.
Okay, maybe I heard butt.
It seems really likely I said butt instead.
There's no way for us to know.
No, it's not like we're recording this. So I harnessed those anxieties. So no, yeah. I don't think anybody thinks I'm chill. I think they think I am decidedly unchill. But I also, if your job is to be creative, a lot of people think you can just turn it on.
Oh, yeah.
And you super can't.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the expectations of sitting in a room and sometimes people look at you and go, well, what would you do? Or what's your opinion? Or what do you think? And I'm like, give me 10 minutes and a notepad and then I'll have some ideas for you. But, like...
My favorite still, like, if I meet someone and someone's... I don't tell anyone this usually because of what happens if someone's like... Oh, this is Levi. He does comedy.
Mm.
The next thing someone always says is,
say
something funny.
Oh, God.
And I now...
No!
Unless I absolutely can't because it's like the horrible space, I usually say, fuck you, because that is the only funny thing to say in response to that request.
That would get a laugh.
People laugh or they never talk to you again. Either way, victory is...
Yeah,
is
that's fine. It doesn't... Yeah, you wanted to accomplish one of those two things anyway.
Because those expectations are terrible. But also
yes.
It doesn't happen in other, like... Rarely do you... I mean, I guess someone's like, you're a doctor, and you're like, will you look at this rash? Like, I guess that does happen.
Yeah.
And then,
I mean, I'm getting a PhD in English. I'm still expected to correct people's grammar, and I'm like, you don't know. Well, some of the
worst...
I would
rather you stop correcting my grammar. I need to tell
you. I don't like correcting grammar. You know what? Let's dispel with this myth right now, okay? First of all,
you just did Muppet arms, but go ahead with your points.
I'm very flaily, okay? I don't have any control over my gestures.
I just want to paint the picture, because people are missing so much, making you two-dimensional.
There's a lot of things happening here. First of all, I do early modern English. This is it's both prior to and just a hair after the standardization of the English language.
Is it when the like O's and E's were smushed together? What's that one letter?
The A and the E and the O.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember what those are called. But the point is, there isn't even one way to technically spell Shakespeare's name. We've just, in the modern world, landed on the particular spelling that we have.
M-A-R-L-O-W-E.
He spelled it different.
M-A-R-L-O-W-E.
Oh, you just want to start fights with me now, don't you?
Yes.
At least you're not an Oxfordian. I wouldn't be able to deal with that.
I had to pick which. I was trying to pick what's the most irritating.
Marlowe is the most irritating.
I thought
it's
was.
True. So, no, okay, a lot of people will say, yeah, bullshit, Katie, you correct our grammar all the time. And
now you should correct them.
I know correct grammar, but I also know the... the social problems with correcting people's grammar, because most often when we're saying that there's a right way to say something, what we're saying is that there's an upper class white way to say something in English. And I take umbrage with that big time. I think that because it often comes down to white people who don't have any familiarity with Black culture or Ebonics or the history of that, they see that as, well, that's bad English.
Right.
No, it's different English. You go around the world and different cultures speak different English. There are some Scots that I just can't understand in the least. When I'm up to the Highlands, it's like they're speaking a different language. different lexicon, different grammar, different sentence structures. There's not one way to speak English.
Well, and language is supposed to be sort of descriptive, not... Yeah. It's not supposed to tell you how to talk. It's supposed to say, oh, this is now how this word's used. That's why literally, I know it makes everyone mad, but it's used that way now.
Yeah. And I actually just on Twitter had a fight with my friend Morgan, if he listens to this. He'll find this funny because I insisted that there's a right way to say GIF in that it's a hard G, not a soft G. And we went back and forth on it. And he said, I mean, I was just friendly trolling. And I was like, yeah, I know. Like, I actually don't ultimately care. I believe GIF feels more right because more people say it that way.
That is the custom,
And that's fine. But I don't, in my heart of hearts, believe in the right or wrong of anything, really, when it comes to English. Because, well, of anything in general.
You believe in the purge.
I believe in relative morality.
Yeah. Great.
Regardless of what we're applying it to. I very much do, actually. There's no cosmic right or wrong. This is why I'm an atheist. See, we're really getting into things here.
Yeah, I'm glad.
So I don't, or when people deride like acronyms on the internet, like don't say LOL, just say like that's funny or something like that. Well, okay, except that you know what it means, right?
Yeah.
When I say LOL, your brain instantly has translated that, like it translates all language that you hear into meaning for yourself. And you can even change what it means within itself. If you do lowercase LOL, period, well, it might be kind of a sarcastic LOL. If it's like LOL, it's not even an acronym anymore.
Right.
It's just a nonsensical thing, but it still holds meaning. And and I think that people who feel like there are people who speak English that sound dumb or bad at it really need to ask themselves what they're actually saying.
Well, should we all sound like reporters? Like, that feels like that's the goal.
Well, certainly would be uninteresting.
Yeah.
There's flowery language for a reason. I love making up words.
No shade at reporters. There's some great reporters.
Well, we need that, too. Standard English is as important, and I'm good at that. If you need me to edit a resume, I'm going to be really good at that because I have to use it in my professional life.
Send your resumes to Katie.
I will charge you money. Remember, I'm almost a doctor.
That's true. So you need money.
I really need money. And also, you can pay me for that degree. I have very strong opinions about the idea of like correcting people's grammar.
I sussed that out.
But I also struggle with it too because I think most people assume that I care a lot about correct grammar.
Anyone with a high level of education, there's some assumption that.
In a sense, I do because I recognize the importance of it, but I also I'm constantly struggling with where it's applicable and where it's just judgmental and not useful.
Well, there's a difference between like laziness and just contextually different.
Exactly.
And so I'm weirder in that like I write and I'm like an editor of things, but I actually find the AP style really boring, which is my own personal struggle because too bad. Like some of the stuff I work on has to be in that style, but it's work for me. It just is work because my brain just doesn't care. My brain is like, I'm so used to writing for the page of things that are going to be performed, and I just prefer that.
Just totally different.
It's very different, but that's my problem. That's not like society's problem.
And I'd like to sit people. This is when I taught Brit Lit class. We started with Beowulf and ended up in the middle of the 17th century.
It's dense.
It was an intense summer class. To read like Chaucer and stuff in the more or less original Old English, late Old English.
It's hard because you have to learn so much to get the jokes.
You do.
That's my trouble with like. It's fun then to get that like context for Chaucer to really like get those jokes. That's the payoff of the learning part. Like you take a college seminar to learn a joke.
It's even the same with Shakespeare. Like you really kind of have to have context that doesn't even register in your brain to get a one-liner or something like that. But to introduce a green classroom of students like Chaucer and Shakespeare, and ask them if they can possibly believe that there's such thing as like standard right or wrong English. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard not to confront those and go, okay, yeah, this is a pretty malleable language that has gone through a lot of changes in not a lot of time. You don't have to go back that far in English history to not even understand what someone's saying.
Well, so I feel like you're answering this a little bit, but I want to sort of more like shove all down, tighten in. Like, do you feel like your pizza roll writing and then your like academic training, like do you see them influencing each other and how you think about the way you're using words? I mean, I'm sure they happen subconsciously, but I'm curious, like when you do like a long form piece that isn't a tweet but it's not an academic paper, do you notice it being influenced by all the other things you're doing?
Well, even if you're writing a 200-page dissertation, brevity is still important.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, for instance, I wrote the first half of my introduction, and I feel like it's very redundant because I'm just kind of brain vomiting right now. And so I got to shape it later, but that means I'm using a lot. I'm saying the same thing four times in a row in four different sentences. I'm not saying it in a concise way in those sentences. So it's like crafting thousands of tweets, mm-hmm. kind of, and going back into that unshaped clay and being like, oh, okay, here's the bulk of stuff. How do I make this sound as concise as I can? Not just for the sake of, it's not conciseness for its own sake. It's like, if I'm going to get my point, what I believe is an extremely important point across to an audience, I have to be as clear as I possibly can. And that is the point of language. The point of language is clarity. The point of language is simply communication. And however it happens doesn't really matter. The only time you have a problem is when you're running into translation problems. If you're talking to me in a way I don't understand, then we're just not having successful communication, even if you're speaking correct English, right? You have to find a way to communicate with people on their grounds. And I know I'm going to have a largely academic audience and my mom reading my dissertation, if even that. I would not belittle the woman if she didn't read my
dissertation. That's why she's going to school. She's trying to get ready to read your dissertation.
It's not that hard. So it's all about audience, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about writing for your audience. And even for an academic audience, I am the person who's an expert on this thing I'm writing on.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people know the periphery things that I'm talking about and know them better than I do, but I'm the person who knows the thing I'm doing.
So you have to remember to keep it accessible to not just you, or
And not, I have to remember to keep it accessible to not just me and to not just an academic audience.
Mm.
There's tiers of that accessibility.
But there's like a fine, I don't know, like a magic hour light place to get where you don't want it too accessible.
That's sometimes is my problem. I think that I let some of my creative writing instincts seep in sometimes, and I like to have imagery, I like to have metaphor, I like to have all those things that sometimes my advisor is like, sometimes he's like, you need to get rid of that, and I often will just fight him on it and say, nope, I'm gonna leave it.
Yeah,
I like the sentence, I'm gonna keep it. And I love the work that I do. Even though I won't be pursuing it academically once I'm done with the PhD, I think that I've never gotten tired of my dissertation work, which That's is shocking something. Considering how long I've been doing it.
I'm tired of it, and it's only been like 40 minutes.
And you don't even know what it is. So 8 years of doing the same thing and still feeling like you can offer something new is, I'm very lucky that I kind of encountered the topic and found a thing that I could stay married to for a while.
Okay, so you just said a couple of sort of trigger things.
Okay.
Should
I give given a trigger warning?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Just for me specifically.
Okay.
No, but so you've been in a relationship 8 years, and then you stay married too.
Mm.
So inevitably, I can't help, like, you have all these buckets. Like, we didn't even talk about it, but like, you like host trivia nights and do other live event type hosting things and
do
a bunch of that stuff and a fair amount of it. And you've been in school your whole life.
Yep.
And you write for internet places.
Yep.
And you have a job where you write in the voice
thinking
of
about it that way.
A delicious, tiny, self-contained pizza.
Little tiny finger pizza pillows, yeah.
So all those things, that's a bunch of time.
Yep.
So how do you manage all that time, and what does that mean for your personal relationships?
Oh, my God.
Which I know is your favorite thing to talk about.
I'm busy. I find...
I thought you were just going to walk off.
I quit. I'm out of here.
You know what? I am busy.
Taking this mic
off. I
got to
go.
I got a lot of shit to do. I don't know what I would do if I wasn't busy. I think I would just waste my time if I didn't have a lot of structured things that I knew I needed to get done.
Do you feel like you're more productive because you have so many things?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. It's not like if you took those things away, I'd become better at the things that remained. I'd just get lazier. Mm. And so I think I am at a good sweet spot in my life for having as many things as I have. And the great thing is, because I'm as introverted, kind of antisocial as I am right now, I always have an excuse.
Mm.
Whether it's mostly true or not, I always have a plausible excuse for why I don't want to go out and do something. So I might have kicked myself in the ass there.
At home.
I've taken to not drinking alone quite as much as I used to. I'll ask upstairs neighbor Bomi to come down and drink with me sometimes. She's in grad school too. She gets it. We live the same life.
You said about kicking yourself in the butt. I cut you off because of my
stupid
joke.
I just mean like now people will know my dirty secret that sometimes I'm lying about.
Everyone knows you're a liar.
Thank goodness. I can just get it off my chest finally. It's fine.
But does that also, like, so you give yourself that out, which I'm the same. Like, I do extroverted in public, but I'm not
right.
It's exhausting and I need to go.
Yes,
be quiet
I always have to recharge after the extroverted stuff.
But is it also a way of, like, are you protecting yourself from some degree of personal relationship? And I don't even mean just romantic relationships. But just like the personal
things. I don't know that I'm necessarily... I have a lot of people I would consider close friends, but I don't know how good I am at being a close friend. I don't think that's a selfishness problem. I think I might have like a slight empathy problem. I don't want it.
Do you mean too much empathy?
No, I mean too little. I don't know. I am limited in the number of people I can have in my life with whom I am so close that I feel as so strongly for them that I conceptualize of them as whole human beings with as whole and human problems and issues and complexities as I have. I might be making myself sound like a monster here. I can't actually tell.
Yeah.
And I do have those friends. I have friends with whom we will just sit and talk about our lives and they will listen and I will listen and we'll respond to each other's things, but I have a very limited capacity for the number of people I can do that for. And I think sometimes it makes me a bad friend.
I think you just articulated something that everyone does, but I have not heard anyone just state it as plainly. That idea of, so you know when there's a baby, mm-hmm. when they can't see something, to them, it doesn't
object
exist permanence, anymore.
Yeah,
I wasn't going to use the word because I didn't want to seem show-offy. But yes.
Let me do it for you.
I think we don't actually ever fully get rid of object permanence with other people.
That's part
of us where we're like, I forgot you. Like, there are people I adore who then suddenly they pop into my world and I'm like, I now notice that I totally forgot about that person.
And I worry that they notice me more than I notice them, or that they don't have that problem with the permanence, that I am in their brains. And it doesn't help that it does kind of make it worse that I do all this hosting stuff and I have wildly disparate groups of friends. I've got grad school friends and friends I've met through the tangential, and I've got music writer and photographer friends, and I've got comedian friends
You're
and improv friends. That's the problem is that how many of those people can be good, deep, true friends and for whom I'm going to be a productive half of that friendship? Probably not a lot, but people perceive me as someone who has a whole bunch of great friends that I spend lots of time with and I'm super close with. And in actuality, that it's very much the opposite. Like, I don't know what I would do without some of my closest friends, because I would, despite the large groups of friends and acquaintances, I would feel so utterly alone if it weren't for those people the number of people I could count on one hand that I can go to and be a friend with, because the din of all of that over there would just be kind of overwhelming and maddening without the pockets of the oases of friendships. And that probably, maybe that's super normal. Maybe it's not. But I feel...
Does it feel like a secret?
Well, not anymore. I said it out loud. it does feel like a thing I struggle with kind of constantly, though, because I want to be there for people, and I also desperately want to just spend time alone. Mm. And I never know how to quite juggle those two. We won't even get into romantic relationships.
Well, you don't.
I ain't got time for that. No, really. I don't know. I don't know. You know, you go through a couple bad relationships and you have to reevaluate your own self. And once you finally do, you realize, I mean, I've built such a life around myself that I don't want to sacrifice my time or myself yet necessarily. And I also know that when I'm done, I've got pipe dreams, you know, I want to like move to the UK, get a work visa, find a job.
Be a full on Anglophile.
Yes. I have to. I feel like I don't believe in souls, but if my soul lives anywhere, it's England. And so that makes it hard to sort of like conceptualize of a long-term anything or other. And I'm kind of okay with that right now. But I also, as I said, just turned 30. They're battling. And I'm from the Midwest. I am from a small Nebraska town.
Where things are done a certain way.
Yes.
And you're behind that.
And I've always fought that. That's never been that much of an influence in my life, and mm-hmm. nobody really expected it to be, least of all my mother, thank goodness. She's just, her number one advice in my entire life has always been, no matter what, just be happy. Just like what you're doing, like the people you're with, nothing else matters.
Yeah.
And that's been thoroughly useful advice. But, you know, once you hit 30 and you realize you're getting old, and I'm almost done with the one thing I've done with more intent and for longer in my life than I've ever done anything,
right.
That's going to be a big cliff to jump off and just go, okay, now what? And then try to figure something out before I hit the bottom.
Do you have a plan?
No. Well, I've got vague plans, you know. I'll finish school. I'll
go
keep...
to England.
No, really, I'm going to put a concerted effort into finding my dream job. Mm. I don't entirely know what it is or what it'll... Or if I just have to create it myself.
Yeah.
But no, I don't have a plan, which to me kind of feels okay because my life for so long has been so heavily dictated by grad school. Like, you can think about your life, but only with this much percentage of energy because this much percentage of energy is still grad school and you're tethered to it forever.
Right, which is constricting but also sort of a relief.
It's very protective.
Yeah.
I have health insurance. I have this thing that I'm doing and it's a constant in my life.
It's one less decision to make,
too. Yes. But in a few months, I won't be there anymore.
And
so
all these new decisions. This might feel like a left turn or something. But I'm really curious if you have, I don't know, the area of like mentors or even like inspirations. So it doesn't have to be like a, like you are sort of in and out of the world of pop culture. You'll make pop culture references in some of the writing that I see. But you also like are living in this sort of ancient literary world too.
Yeah.
So do you, are there like specific writers or artists who mean a lot to you? Or are there other sort of educators in your life? Like what are your dynamics there?
Probably my biggest influence right now is my advisor, my academic advisor.
How long has that been? Like how long is that?
Since I moved here, so 2010, 6 years.
Okay.
Almost seven. Yeah. I moved here.
Was it just you were assigned to that person?
No, I moved here. I applied here because I wanted to work with him.
Oh, wow.
This was the number one place I wanted to be. I applied lots of places for PhDs, but this was where I felt like I needed to be to do the work I wanted to do with this guy who's in my field. So it's weird entering into that relationship already kind of feeling fangirly.
Yeah.
But it's ended up being the most productive, fruitful, collaborative relationship I've had.
Hmm.
In any field that I've worked in. He's extremely admirable. He's the brightest person I know. He's extremely prolific with his scholarship. He's always writing two books at the same time. He's lived an amazing life. He respects the work that I do, and he will bring new work to me. Like if somebody comes to him and says, well, we need an encyclopedia entry written for this edition of an encyclopedia coming out, he'll pass it to me. If there's a book that needs reviewed for a prestigious journal, he'll pass it to me. And I've done things I wouldn't have otherwise been able to do because he trusts me to do them. And so it's an admiration relationship because I'm floored by his scholarship, but it's also like he also respects what I do. And the
so
fact that I respect him
too.
So much. Yeah. So the fact that I respect him so much makes me more confident because he then in turn respects
me. He wouldn't invest in a dummy.
I certainly hope he wouldn't. That would really suck.
What happens with that kind of relationship when school ends?
I don't know. I'm worried about
that. Have you talked about that or is that...
No. I mean, the thing is, like, normally you would get a job and you'd move away to wherever the job is, no matter where in the United States it is. And,
like if you became a teacher.
Yeah, and you take the jobs that are available to you that you get offered,
which
no matter where they are.
Moving somewhere else.
Almost always.
Not, yeah.
I'll be here for a while.
Yeah.
And I would, like, he's gone most of every summer, and I'm just kind of a mess when he's gone because I want to, like, go talk to him about my intro or talk to him about this or talk to him about the Republican National Convention. We'll have to talk for hours about, like, politics and stuff because he has such important insights, especially into, like, the Middle East because he's Lebanese and he's extremely knowledgeable and all that stuff. So I feel like I'm constantly learning from him. And he's interested in my opinions as a 30-year-old woman in the United States growing up. In my own political context, and I'm not afraid to share those opinions. And so I'll be here; he'll still be in my life. But I do wonder. I do worry, like how our. I hope it doesn't fall by the wayside. I think I'd be a lesser person without him, kind of as a constant. So That's probably the big one. I have a lot of writers that I admire a lot. I wish I was as funny as like Lindy West or Mallory Ortberg,
Shrill,
who writes for...
Everyone should read Shrill.
I want to get to it. Like, I'm in the middle of Catch 22 right now,
so
actually.
Funny.
But
oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know that one. I just realized I hadn't read it, and I needed to. And then I'm going to read... I don't know. I've got a long list. I'm going to read Citizen next. I downloaded that on my on my Kindle. But so lots of writer, like I have a lot of female writers that I super, super, super admire because they're so fucking funny. I'm so sad the toast isn't going to be a thing anymore because Mallory is freaking hilarious in the precise way that I wish I was. And so there's that's more of a like I'm jealous of how good you are type of admiration.
Yeah, I go in and out of like being excited about that and then find that intimidating.
Right.
And I'm like, what's the point?
But that's maybe that's the thing that either that will either help me decide if that's the thing I want to pursue and constantly have anxiety about or if I just fundamentally don't feel like I'm good enough. Either way, it'll help me come to a decision in my life. Who knows?
Do you feel like you've been able to be like a mentor to people? Have you been able to do any of that? As a
I mean,
teacher?
I have with my sisters.
Yeah.
As a teacher, yeah. I mean, there's some there have been some students who I've like maintained even like brief relationships with after we've been done with classes because they'll seek me out for letters of recommendation or something like that. And that always feels good. You feel like you've done well. And when you get class evaluations back that say like, I super wasn't into this class and then I took it with you and I had a really good time. And that's nice. But I think most important thing to me is how productive can I be in my little sister's lives? Because we're just close enough in age that I can see the parts of them that are me and the parts of them that aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And learning that, like, those parts are okay, too, and helping cultivate the sides of them that aren't like me.
Yeah.
Like, it's most important to me that I hope I have been a force for good in their lives. Because like I said, we're all pursuing our schooling in the way that we are. And I hope that they are as into what they do now, in part because I've been as into what I do.
Like, you're modeling that. It's not about them being into what you're into.
Right,
about...
but the hard work and the, like, knowing what you want to do and really feeling it and feeling confident in what you do, feeling... I mean, we're three women raised by a woman, raised largely alone by a woman. And so I think that my mom's done a good job setting that up for us. It's just strong, loud women. Loud in a good way.
Yeah.
That, and I do mean that. Loud and aggressive and opinionated in all the good ways.
Yeah, so tell me about... So I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I just had a discussion with her. She's been called bossy since she was, like, two.
Mm-hmm.
And for a tiny while, I was like, oh, she's really... And then I was like, no, I need to greenlight the shit out of this.
Yeah.
And so we talk about it all the time because she doesn't like getting teased about it. But then when we talk about it, she's like, Dad, I know it's good. It's just because boys are treated different than girls. Like, please don't give me that lecture again. So I'm really curious about, you know, you're in a really interesting place. You're a 30-year-old woman.
Yeah.
Who is making her own way in a lot of ways. We have like a few minutes.
Okay.
What is the state of womanhood? How do we solve
it? It's okay.
How do
I mean,
we solve...
what time is it? Hillary Clinton could be speaking this very moment.
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
It's amazing. And also
it's
still
amazing
like,
to me
I don't
that
feel
there's
like people
a...
are making a big enough deal out of...
Well, there's a likelihood, a very strong likelihood that there will be children born
with
in the next
no
few
white
months.
Dudes.
My
daughter's
first president was a woman.
Well, my daughter's first president was a black
guy. It was
Obama. And if she wins and then another term, she'll become an adult and a no white dude was ever president.
Isn't that
wonderful? Be the best.
Yes. So the state of womanhood is good. The problem, I'm going to throw a big old asterisk behind that though, because the problem with saying, yes, it's good, all's great, is that just belies so much that isn't good. And the better things get outwardly, the easier it is for us to stop recognizing the things that aren't good systemically underneath.
If we stop the bleeding, then we don't have to fix anything else.
Exactly. It's not something we just could put a Band-Aid on to continue your metaphor.
Thank you.
Yeah. It was a good one. It was productive. So, and I do think that what it ultimately comes down to is on that individual woman level. I really, 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 really hope, and actually I believe ultimately that my sisters do feel empowered to, if they ever feel belittled because they're women or feel like they aren't allowed to have an opinion about something or aren't allowed to have such a loud opinion about something or aren't as good at something or anything like that, I hope that they will immediately become extremely hostile toward that idea because I do, to the point where I just get told, you are legitimately difficult, Katie. And there's part of me thinks they may be right. I might be pushing it a little bit too hard sometimes. But I need to it's like a practice, because so much of everyday life pushes against that strength that it's like building up a tolerance to something, and I'm okay with going a little overboard on it.
It's better to overcorrect than not.
And I hope that they know that. I really hope they do. They are 23 and 21 years old, and I hope that they do that, because I wasn't that good at it at their age. I didn't really start believing in the importance of calling myself a feminist until I was probably late college, master's degree. So state of womanhood is good as long as we keep working on just empowering the individuals. And I think Hillary will be good for that. You know, politicking aside and emails aside and DNC aside, it's good.
I like that answer. That seems hopeful. Mm-hmm. Where should people go? Which places should people find you on the internet?
I'm a highly Googleable person.
You are. Do you want to be connected with?
People can find me on the Tangential. I'm on the author page. My whole archive is there. You can follow Totino's on the internet at Totino's on Twitter. My name. Just search my name. I've got short stories people can read. I've got things I've written, podcasts I've done. Yeah. I'm out there.
Well, I'm really excited to see what happens after you're done with school.
I'll send you my dissertation, and you can look at it and go, oh, okay, and then close that window.
Perfect. It's a deal.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking to me, Katie. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. This was nice.
Ray.
Yeah.
Thank you.